Good morning. My name is Kathy Hedge, and I'm a member of this fellowship. And for those of you who come from a heritage of Hanukkah and blessed candles, or Christmas with mangers and stars, or stand under oak and fir to celebrate the winter solstice and the coming of the light, you are welcome here. For those seeking your own celebrations or sanctuary to escape from those you've known, you are welcome here. We are a fellowship of Unitarian Universalists who meet to express our individual beliefs and religious convictions. We belong to the national organization, the Unitarian Universalist Association of Congregations, and are members of the UUA Prairie Star District. The Unitarian Universalist Association has no creed or prophet or sacred book, but we agree on seven principles that are listed in the back of your bulletin. And visitors, and I see some lovely visitors today, you're invited to join us after our service for coffee and conversation. And if you are new to the fellowship, and those of you who are our guests, if you'd like to introduce yourself, you're welcome to do so. But what we would like you to do is to please wait for the microphone so everybody will be able to hear you okay today. It's lovely to see your smiling faces on this cold morning. Do we have anyone who would like to introduce your visitors, or would like to introduce yourself? You know? I was hoping you'd do that.
Enel Forrester. I was going to do it on Joys and Concerns, but my son and daughter, Beth and Kent, are here visiting for a couple of days, and then we'll head on for Kansas City for Christmas with the great-grandkids and their grandkids. Yay. So they're visiting today.
Hi, Ann Marchin. I've got my son visiting this weekend, and we're all heading to Kansas City for Christmas, too. So glad to have him here with me.
Welcome. All right. Do we have anyone else who'd like to introduce themselves? Okay.
What?
Well, then I'll embarrass them and introduce our two sons that are here. Dylan, some of you have met already, who's living in Manhattan right now, intending to go to K-State. And Tyler is visiting from Boston, where he's going to grad school. And it's wonderful to have them here. And tomorrow we fly out to California to visit my dad and Dave's dad. So really looking forward to it.
Welcome. Now would you like to take a moment, since we know everybody is here now, take a moment and greet those around you. Thank you. Now, would you please join us in the hymn? For those of you who are guests, we have hymnals usually in the little slot right underneath the chair in front of you. And we are going to sing hymn 55, Dark of Winter. And lovely Dick Beeman is going to join me in leading this. If you'll stand, please, if you're able.
Dark of winter, soft and still, your quiet calm surrounds me.
Let my thoughts go where they will, ease my mind profoundly, and then my soul will sing a song, a blessed song of love eternal. Gentle darkness, soft and still, bring your quiet to me. Darkness, soothe my weary eyes, that I may see more clearly. When my heart with sorrow cries, comfort and caress me. And then my soul may hear a voice, a still small voice of love eternal. Darkness, when my fears arise, let your peace flow through me.
Thank you, Dick. And now we're going to have a response reading. And this is in the back of your hymnal. It's number 616, For So the Children Come. So if you could find that in your responsive and read the ones, the pieces that are in italics. And I will lead you. For so the children come. For so the children come, and so they have been coming. Always in the same way they come, born of the seed of man and woman. No angels herald their beginnings. No prophets predict their future courses. No wise men see a star to show where to find that babe that will save humankind. Yet each night a child is born is a holy night. Fathers and mothers sitting beside their children's cribs feel glory in the sight of a new life beginning. They ask, where and how will this new life end, or will it ever end? Each night a child is born is a holy night, a time for singing, a time for wondering, a time for worshiping. Thank you. Now, we look to our families or those who are family for us to light our way through the dark, for those who are our light bearers, those who have gone before us and those who stand beside us. We light this chalice. And now we'd like to add to our introductions earlier, and if you have joys or concerns that you would like to share with the fellowship, we'd love to hear those from you. And again, we'll have Doug will pass around the microphone.
Hi, I'm Mike Benella. It is my joy to wish everyone a very happy Festivus on the day of Festivus. So that's my favorite holiday this time of year.
Enel Forrester again. Great joy to have Kent and Beth here, but also they celebrated yesterday their 33rd anniversary.
Yay.
On the solstice. So.
Yay.
Tom Phillips, joy and a concern. Earlier this week, I celebrated my 55th birthday.
Yay!
And so I'm as old as the Burger King Whopper. Saw that on a bag somewhere. But my concern, unfortunately, is sad, as we've had several people ill in my family, and that was bad enough. And then with all the news of gun violence in the country, you know, you think, wow, man, I can't imagine that happening. Well, yesterday morning, my sister sent an email. We determined we're about two steps removed from something that happened in western Pennsylvania Friday. If anybody's familiar with that part of the world near Pittsburgh, a place called Altoona, a little smaller town called Hollidaysburg, where all of the cousins on my mother's side live, and there was a man with a gun. He killed three people, and one of them was my cousin-in-law's cousin, so not a blood relative, but it turned out that, you know, my cousin Marie Brenneman was quoted on news blogs and on TV all over the country yesterday describing that because she knew the people. And, you know, some of the families couldn't go back to their homes because they were crime scenes, so they were at a community center having food. But I just thought, wow. So it's just been just kind of a sad Saturday.
As many of you may know already, Yvonne has been in a retirement home in Boulder, very close to daughter Jane, and with whom she shares a lot of meals and whatnot. It's what she's been talking of a long while, not what I could stand, especially in the middle of a city like Boulder. And she calls to check on me every morning, more or less, and she seems to be really quite content, feeling very secure, where she has lots of backup. And at 84, she didn't want to be where she had to depend on and take care of me as already old. I think it's an arrangement that's going to work out, though my cooking is not that great.
Mark Mosier, I've got a great joy. As some of you know, my son Nicholas, and Nicholas got married here last month. I'm a little slow getting around to telling everybody, but I married a lovely lady named Tara, and they are living in Alaska.
Yippee.
Gene Severs, after threatening, I mean, considering places like UC Davis and Missouri and Colorado State, just recently Michaela sent her acceptance for a scholarship to Kansas State University, and I'm thrilled. Might see her here for a little while longer in the community band in Wamego. And Jessica, her older sister, has successfully completed one more semester of nursing school, so she has one semester left at Washburn.
Thank you. Congratulations to everyone who has celebrations, and for those of you who have sorrows or those you have not expressed, please know that our hearts are with you. And now what we'd like to do is one of our favorite things is to have a children's conversation. We do have some kids that I would love to have you come up here and share a story with me. And the story is called The Snow Bear. It has really pretty pictures. Hey, Jake, if you come over here, I'll let you touch the pictures because they're bumpy. Good morning, and thank you for coming up. Are you comfortable? Okay. Well, we have this lovely book. How many of you have seen this before? The Snow Bear? You ever seen that? This one? Well, I think you'll like that. Why don't you have a seat right there? Perfect, perfect. Okay, so I want you, our program today, we're going to be talking about winter and all the different ways that people celebrate winter or see winter, even in places the seasons change, where they don't change very much because they're at the equator. But what I want you to think about today is imagine it's the very coldest night of the year and the longest night of the year, and you're by yourself and you're your age. And you're out there and lost. Now, I hope that would never happen to you, because I know everybody watches very carefully for you. But let's imagine that you were a little bear, and that was happening to you. So if you feel a little cold while this is going on, then that's okay. All right, the Snow Bear. In the silent forest is a clearing where the snowflakes fall. But listen, there's padding and pancing. I'm sorry, pouncing, and a snowdrift shivers. A little white bear bursts out into the clearing. He looks left, he looks right, he looks high and low for his mother.
Isn't that cute?
Yeah, kind of ticklish. Mother, where are you? Calls the little white bear. He waits and waits, but she does not come. I will make a snow mother, he whispers, to keep me company while I wait. The little white bear sweeps snow into a mother shape. But listen, there's snuffless and swishing and a deep crunch of snow, and Musk Ox shakes his shaggy coat. Let me help, he says, and he heaves a heavy mound of snow with his strong shoulder. These Musk Ox. We don't have those in Kansas, do we? There's stirrings and whirrings in a soft, snowy landing. Snow Goose smooths her feathers. Let me help, she says. And she pats down the snow with her wide, webbed feet. There's splintering and splashing coming from the icy lake. Moose nuzzles the little white cub. Okay, let's show people that. Why don't you stand right there? Here, right here. So you can stand right here. There, you can still feel it, okay? Moose nuzzles the little white cub with his velvet muzzle. Let me help, he says. And he shovels more snow with his sweeping antlers. See those antlers? Isn't that cool? And look, all the animals are still there, all trying to help the little snow bear make a snow mummy. There's skidding and sliding and sounds of claws on ice. Fox twitches her frisky whiskers. Let me help, she says. And she shapes the feet with her quick, curved paws. You see little fox? How come she's white?
Because she's a fox that lives in cold.
Yes, but during the summer, is she white? No. She's brown during the summer and white during the winter. So she can hide, okay? Ooh, look at this. Look, isn't that? See, that's coming along. Okay, let's see what happens next. There's panting and pawing and a lot of tail wagging, and Wolf sniffs the air with his long, sharp nose. Let me help, he says, and he brushes in the fur marks with his big, bushy tail. So there we have Wolf helping out. What's next? There's hopping and stopping and two long ears flopping. Hare stares with her dark liquid eyes. I love the words in this book. Sorry, I'm out of character. Okay. Let me help, she says, and she draws the face with her neat, narrow paws. We'll show them too.
It's beautiful.
Oh, thank you. Bear, Hare, and Wolf, Snow Goose, and Moose, Musk Ox, and Fox finish the snow bear just as the sun sets and the world is washed in gold. But listen, from a forest their mothers call them home, all except for the little white bears. Goodbye, he says sadly, as they disappear in the dusk. Thank you for your help. All the animals going home to their mom. And what do you think little snow bear does? Snuggles up to the snow. Darkness settles over the clearing, and the little white cub snuggles up against the snow bear, wishing it were already morning. As he sleeps, warm winds blow from the south and soften the snow. Slowly, slowly, the snow bear melts into the green of the forest. But listen, as dawn breaks, who comes sniffling and searching through the trees? Who do you think? Oh, look at that. Good job. There she is. Want to pet the mom? Is she pretty? Okay. Yeah, here you go. Come on up. There. Isn't that beautiful? Yeah. Isn't that neat? And here there's more on this page, too. Want to pet this page, too? In the clearing, a new day begins. A familiar scent awakens the little white bear. He blinks sleepily. It's you, he murmurs, moving closer to his mother's side. I knew you would find me. The end. Oh, I think, yeah, the end. All right, there you go. Isn't it? See that? Okay. Well, thank you very much. And now we'll send you. Ready for the song? pretty. Would you like to take that back with you? Kaya, would you like to take that back? And you guys can look at it some more. Oh, you can hold the camera. All right. Would you take this back? Okay.
Go now and please. May the Spirit of love surround you everywhere you may go.
Thank you. And now our offertory. We have Pat Embers. If you would, are ready to come up and share with us the ages past and surviving the dark.
Welcome, and I'm glad to be here today. Winter is my favorite season, oddly enough. And the snow, the quietness, I thought the hymn was perfect today as an introduction for my reading. So I won't waste time. I have this book that I got at the Heard Museum in Phoenix when Sheila lived there. And the collection of this Arctic, mostly wooden stone collection carvings and some drawings, but it was just astounding. And I got this book, and I've read a lot of it. But what I'm going to do is read little clips of the book throughout, and I have it numbered. We'll see how this works. The subtitle is Inuit Art. It's from the collection of the Albrecht Collection at the Heard Museum. The Inuit peoples are one of several groups that live in the most northerly reaches of the planet. The wider circumpolar context includes not only Inuit groups in northeastern Siberia, northern Alaska and Canada, and Greenland, but also a host of other cultures, including the Sami, or Laplanders, of Scandinavia and northwestern Russia, and many others from Siberia, the Aleut of Alaska, and several subarctic Indian nations across Alaska and Canada. The present circumpolar Inuit population is about 150,000. Across the Arctic today, Inuit live in permanent villages with modern services and conveniences, struggling to keep their traditions alive in the face of assimilation and southern influences. The Inuit homelands of the Canadian Arctic cover more than 1 million square miles. Their lands include giant glaciers, ice-cold lakes and rivers, mountains and fjords, and treeless tundra. A harsh, dark winter settles over the land for 6 to 7 months of the year. Bone-chilling temperatures reach as low as minus 75 degrees Fahrenheit. And howling blizzards can virtually shut down whole communities for days on end. Each summer, the surrounding oceans thaw just long enough to allow a single sea lift of supplies to most settlements. Only then do the top few inches of soil thaw. But in that brief time, the Arctic is transformed into a beautiful northern meadowland environment lit by the midnight sun. Flowers bloom and berries ripen quickly, and throngs of migrating caribou, birds, fish, seals, and whales fill the land, air, and waters. Their art, which is what this book is about, is a memory art that not only records but also symbolizes an ancient way of life. The idea that Inuit carvers, quote, listen to the stone, quote unquote, has taken on almost mythic proportions. This is what one Cape Dorset sculptor has to say on the subject, and there will be quotes and narratives throughout this. The stone has a life of its own, even to the point that it may want to move, so I will shape it to that movement. Sometimes you have to stop and look at the stone as if you are talking to it, and then the shape emerges. Traditionally, Inuit dependence on animals was virtually total. Animals are portrayed with such love, respect, and attention to detail. It's a quote. I love to go out and watch the wild animals, even though I'm not planning to shoot them, observing how they move and what they look like, just watching them. If we have enough food, we don't shoot. We just watch them. Birds play a special role in the Arctic. Birds figure prominently in myths and legends, and their raucous cries are mimicked by Inuit throat singers. Shamans emulated birds on their spirit journeys. Owls are good to eat. They taste like polar bears. The meat is nice and fatty. They taste a bit like turkey, too. I've seen lots of owls, just like I've seen polar bears. Owls are playful, like bear cubs. I enjoy hearing the sounds they make. The caribou used to gather in a very large herd to migrate. We would sit where they would pass and wait for them. It would take 3 to 5 days and nights for the herd to pass our camp. They were not afraid in such big numbers. We would walk among them and pick out the fat ones. We would kill them carefully without frightening the herd. The greatest peril of life lies in the fact, that human food consists entirely of souls. All the creatures that we have to kill and eat, all those that we have to strike down and destroy to make clothes for ourselves, have souls like we have, souls that do not perish with the body. When I was younger, I often felt grief over killing a beautiful animal, even though it was for food. The older people wisely told us that killing animals must be purposeful and not simply for sport. This is a picture of the Baker Lake scene. The Hudson Bay store did not even have heat. There used to be a lot of people coming into Baker Lake at Christmas and Easter. They had no vehicles except a boat. A long time ago, the only thing people owned was a sled and a dog team. Our grandfather and grandmother always used to sing ay 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 songs. My sisters are good singers, and I'm the artist in the family. The family is so important. It's the top priority for all Inuit. Children are seen to embody the spirits of deceased relatives and so are treated with both love and respect. Orphans are quickly taken into other families, and childless couples, including grandparents, are often given children to adopt. Children know and respect both their natural and adoptive parents. Young Inuit children enjoy great freedom. They stay up late and often travel from house to house where they are showered with treats and affection. Among Inuit, one of the chief entertainments was storytelling. Stories range from the day's hunting exploits to myths and legends. These tales were not frivolous. Music, song, and dance were also important. The drum dance allowed people to sing their personal songs, poke fun at each other, and even settle disputes through, quote, song duels. Another form of entertainment, throat singing, or katayag, was usually performed by two women. When we were starving, I used to carry my dolls on my back because I did not want to leave them behind. My mother said to leave them behind, but I never did. They wore traditional clothing made out of caribou skin. I used to love making dolls with the clothing on. I was born at Kahigayik. When I was growing up, we lived in an igloo. We had a really hard time when we were living in that area. My first memory is from the age of 7. My brother, Krinitsky, and I were alone in the igloo during a big blizzard, and we were starving. My mother remembered that she had seen some caribou hooves out on the tundra. She left in the afternoon and was not back by the evening. The blizzard was getting stronger. It was really dark when we heard her returning. She had just one caribou hoof in her hand. My mother cooked the hoof and told us to eat it. She wouldn't have any herself. The three of us were alone in the igloo because my father and older brothers had gone out to hunt for caribou. They were out for a long, long time, and we were very hungry. When my older brother, Isumatoryoak, came in and saw us so thin from starvation, he began to cry. He gave us some food, but he warned us not to eat too much at once, or we might die. I was just a young girl, and I didn't understand why he was telling us not to eat too much. Excuse me, all my page turning. Birds, bears, and walruses were considered to be the shamans. I'm sorry, this is first page is on shamanism. The Inui shaman, or Anakog, was the equivalent of the medicine man or woman in other tribal cultures. The shaman mediated between people and the spirit world in order to influence the weather, ensure a steady supply of animals, heal the sick, and enforce taboos. The Angakog was treated with a mixture of respect and fear by fellow Inui. Quote, "Nobody talks about shamanism too much. I guess when the missionaries went up there, they stopped all these legends. Still today, the elders are hesitant to tell too many legends. To them, it was told it was a sin." Birds, bears, and walruses were considered to be the shaman's most powerful helping spirits. The things a shaman did, like healing the sick or putting curses on people, you cannot see. I am not trying to tell you about shamanism. I'm just telling you a bit about what I have heard and seen. In the old days, Inui did things that you will never see. Myths and legends. In Inui mythology, the worlds of humans and animals were completely intertwined. Animals and people spoke together, intermarried, had children together, and sometimes fought. Shamanism, transformation, and spirits were central elements of these stories. One of these stories is called the sea goddess holding fish. The sea goddess controlled the animals of the ocean. If taboos were broken, or if the goddess was otherwise angered, she could whip up a terrible storms and bring starvation to the people. Most depictions of Sedna portray her as what in Europe tradition, European tradition, would be called a mermaid. She was half woman and half sea creature, generally a seal, walrus, whale, or fish. And the last quote is on the back. We carve the animals because they are important to us as a food. We carve Inui figures because in that way we can show ourselves to the world as we were in the past and as we are now. There is nothing marvelous about it. It is just the truth. From the Arctic Circle.
Good morning. My reading will lead us to the Arctic at the very end as well, but we will start somewhere else. It's Who is St. Nicholas? I got this from the St. Nicholas Center on the internet. The true story of Santa Claus begins with Nicholas, who was born during the 3rd century in the village of Patara. At the time, the area was Greek and is now on the southern coast of Turkey. His wealthy parents, who raised him to be a devout Christian, died in an epidemic while Nicholas was still young. Obeying Jesus' words to sell what you own and give the money to the poor, Nicholas used his whole inheritance to assist the needy, the sick, and the suffering. He dedicated his life to serving God and was made Bishop of Myra while still a young man. Bishop Nicholas became known throughout the land for his generosity to those in need, his love for children, and his concern for sailors and ships. He died December 6, 343, in Myra, and was buried in his cathedral church. The anniversary of his death became a day of celebration, St. Nicholas Day. Through the centuries, many stories and legends have been told of St. Nicholas' life and deeds. These accounts help us understand his extraordinary character and why he is so beloved and revered as protector and helper of those in need. One story tells of a poor man with three daughters. In those days, a young woman's father had to offer prospective husbands something of value, a dowry. The larger the dowry, the better the chance that a young woman would find a good husband. Without a dowry, a woman was unlikely to marry. These poor man's daughters without dowries were therefore destined to be sold into slavery. Mysteriously, on three different occasions, a bag of gold appeared in their home, providing the needed dowries. The bags of gold, tossed through an open window, are said to have landed in stockings or shoes left before the fire to dry. This led to the custom of children hanging stockings or putting out shoes, eagerly awaiting gifts from St. Nicholas. Sometimes the story is told with gold balls instead of bags of gold. That is why three gold balls, sometimes represented as oranges, are one of the symbols for St. Nicholas. And so St. Nicholas is a gift giver. One of the oldest stories showing St. Nicholas as a protector of children takes place long after his death. The townspeople of Myra were celebrating the good saint on the eve of his feast day when a band of pirates came into the district. They stole treasures from the church of St. Nicholas to take away as booty. As they were leaving town, they snatched a young boy, Basilios, to make into a slave. The king selected Basilios to be his personal cupbearer, as not knowing the language, Basilios would not understand what the king said to those around him. So, for the next year, Basilios waited on the king, bringing his wine in a beautiful golden cup. For Basilios' parents, devastated at the loss of their only child, the year passed slowly, filled with grief. As the next St. Nicholas feast day approached, Basilios' mother would not join in the festivity, as it was now a day of tragedy. However, she was persuaded to have a simple observance at home. Meanwhile, as Basilios was fulfilling his task serving the king, he was suddenly whisked up and away. St. Nicholas appeared to the terrified boy, blessed him, and set him down at his home back in Myra. Imagine the joy and wonderment when Basilios amazingly appeared before his parents, still holding the king's golden cup. This is the first story told of St. Nicholas protecting children, which became his primary role in the West. Several stories tell of Nicholas and the sea. When he was young, Nicholas sought the holy by making a pilgrimage to the Holy Land. Returning by sea, a mighty storm threatened to wreck the ship. Nicholas calmly prayed. The terrified sailors were amazed when the wind and waves suddenly calmed, sparing them all. And so, St. Nicholas is the patron of sailors and voyagers. Other stories tell of Nicholas saving his people from famine, sparing the lives of those innocently accused, and much more. He did many kind and generous deeds in secret, expecting nothing in return. Within a century of his death, he was celebrated as a saint. Today, he is venerated in the East as wonder or miracle worker, and in the West as patron of a great variety of persons, children, mariners, bankers, pawnbrokers, scholars, orphans, laborers, travelers, merchants, judges, paupers, marriageable maidens, students, sailors, victims of judicial mistakes, and captives. He is known as the friend and protector of all in trouble or need. Sailors claiming St. Nicholas as patron carried stories of his favor and protection far and wide. St. Nicholas' chapels were built in many seaports. As his popularity spread during the Middle Ages, he became the patron saint of Apulia, Sicily, Greece, and Lorraine, and many cities in Germany, Austria, Switzerland, Italy, Russia, Belgium, and the Netherlands. Nicholas was so widely revered that thousands of churches were named for him, including 300 in Belgium, 34 in Rome, 23 in the Netherlands, and more than 400 in England. Through the centuries, St. Nicholas has continued to be venerated by Catholics and Orthodox and honored by Protestants. By his example of generosity to those in need, especially children, St. Nicholas continues to be a model for the compassionate life. Widely celebrated in Europe, St. Nicholas' feast day, December 6, kept alive the stories of his goodness and generosity. In Germany and Poland, boys dressed as bishops begged alms for the poor and sometimes for themselves. In the Netherlands and Belgium, St. Nicholas arrived on a steamship from Spain to ride a white horse on his gift-giving rounds. December 6 is still the main day for gift-giving and merrymaking in much of Europe. For example, in the Netherlands, St. Nicholas is celebrated on the 5th, the eve of the day, by sharing candies thrown in the door, chocolate initial letters, small gifts, and riddles. Dutch children leave carrots and hay in their shoes for the saint's horse, hoping, excuse me, St. Nicholas will exchange them for small gifts. In Germany, children also will leave their shoes out in the evening of December 5th if they don't expect a personal visit from St. Nicholas on the 6th. But they don't put hay and carrots in them. They just make sure they are clean. How, when, and why St. Nicholas moved to the North Pole, and when he decided to employ elves to help him getting toys ready for girls and boys all around the world, however, is still a mystery that should be told another time. He probably brings gifts in the United States on December 25th because he's running out of toys on December 6th in Europe, and his elves have to hustle and bustle to finishing everything for all the children in this country, which just takes another 2.5 weeks. Thank you.
Thank you, Elka and Pat. We're going to change up the order a little bit, and I'm going to read you a rather unusual Santa Claus story. And this is, I'm only going to read portions of it, but this is called Red Ranger Came Calling by Berkeley Breathed. And it is unusual. Oh, I'm seeing some smiles. You've seen it before. Okay. All right, well, this story features a rather persnickety little boy. It is a rather ugly child, unfortunately. And he does not have a happy disposition. But most of all, he is unhappy because he is yearning to be the Red Ranger, flying through space with his enormous, beautiful bicycle. And this bicycle, I have to give you the proper term, is a official Buck Tweed 2-speed Crime Stopper Starhopper bicycle. And it is featured at Vachon Hardware Store. And he spends the day sitting in front of the window in bicycle poverty with his aunt's dog, who is a Dalmatian wiener dog mix, at his feet. And they sit there both looking very mournful, spend the whole day. But one day on his way home to his aunt's place, he doesn't hurry because neither of them really get along very well. So he doesn't hurry home. And on his way, on one of his detours, he comes by Point Robinson. Point Robinson is the place where the islanders say that Santa Claus has come and is hiding out and spending his last days. Well, of course, the boy doesn't believe this one whit until on his detour, he sees an astonishingly squat little man, no bigger than me, who rushed past us toward the old lighthouse. He carried an overnight carpet bag, which bumped along behind him. The tiny man smiled weakly and tipped his hat, revealing pointy ears. Something flowery needed to be said by the Red Ranger of Mars, but in my shock, all that came out was, "Mister, you look like a turnip." I could not recall ever actually seeing a genuine elf, nor calling anyone a vegetable, but I was certain that I just had an elf. You know whose elf. To a dyed-in-the-wool everything doubter such as myself, it was mind-boggling. So the little boy is out of sorts. His aunt sees it, and so she decides to let him open his Christmas package early. And at first he is so excited because it opens up and he sees the bright red. It was a glorious Buck Tweed space uniform, the bonus highlight being a large red R zooming across the breastplate. I tried it on, and she flung a hand across her brow, swooning from the swashbuckling drama of it all. We had finally discovered our first bit of common ground. I forgot to tell you, I'm sorry, that this is happening in 1939, Christmas 1939, in the depths of the Depression. But my Space Ranger senses detected that the jersey was in truth last year's cast-off pajama top, dyed ranger red and altered by the loving hands of its giver. "Pajamas," I said with crushing disappointment. I didn't speak again, but my fingers explored the familiar cloth, and my expression hid none of my defeat. Vi turned away, hiding her own. I did not typically give much thought to the feelings of others, and true to form, I did not that night. My mother used to tell me that there was a natural order to all things and that mine must have been prickliness. She said that blaming me or anybody else for my distant nature would be like blaming a polar bear for eating Canadians. It was a natural order, and that was that. I thought of this as I went up to bed. But as I lay there in the dark, my thoughts returned to the earlier elf sighting. He had looked like the real thing, and elves to Santa Claus are like horseflies to horses. One means the other is nearby. For a child, even me, it was all too tempting to believe. But then, wasn't everything and everybody? It occurred to me that a kid's life was one long opportunity for having the rug pulled out from below him at every step. Myself, I was determined to stay on my feet. Still, a fraud was surely afoot, and it was sworn duty of the Red Ranger of Mars to stick his nose deep into such things. Amelia, that's the dog, followed, looking doubtful. As I dropped out my window, I bent low and then crept off in the island fog to unmask a humbug. The Sonderklaas house teetered high above the pounding surf, the moon igniting the rising mist into blue phosphorescence. Ancient toys in disrepair littered the steps like ghosts from a baby's bad dream. We clambered past an old sign nailed into the rock. He's climbing up the hill. And the sign reads, "Visitors not received with zesty jolliness at the moment." I almost turned back right there. I was growing uneasy about the whole matter, and a public guarantee of grumpiness didn't help, and I knocked on the huge door unzestfully. The big door swung open slowly on rusty hinges. The little pointy-eared man from before stood there holding a tea tray, scowling. The light from an enormous fire behind him made the room flicker with grotesque shadows. My thoughts turned to retreat, but instead I stood at attention. "The Red Ranger has come calling," I said, and bowed deeply over shaky knees. The little man scowled further, but motioned for us to enter. The terrible shadows were caused by monstrous toys looming in the dark corners, and dozing in a fantastic chair was what I figured to be old Sonderklaas, the most ancient man I had ever seen. He coughed quietly and breathed with a rattling wheeze of great antiquity. His body, shrunken and folded, looked as though it had retreated from life itself. Before I could announce myself, he spoke up without looking up. "Turn around," he said in a voice the age of the mountains. "Go home. Go back to bed. What you're looking for isn't here. I'm 435 years old, which makes me very tired." Even in my mounting terror, I was grateful to meet another skilled liar. "I'm Buck Tweed, the Red Ranger of Mars, 602 years old," I said, adding as a bonus, "and I do not believe at all in Santa Claus." With that, the little elf shuddered and looked in horror to his master, whose eyes had ignited. The old man began to push himself up from his huge chair and finally looked at me, glowering. Frankly, this was more than I could take. I panicked and shot the old faker with my disintegrator ray gun. The old man sank back into his chair, stunned, as if a tuna fish were stuck to his forehead and not a dart. He pulled it off and then motioned with a bony hand for me to approach. I did, deeply regretting my violence. When I got done, he took my pistol and held it up gingerly for a better look. His eyes widened. "Never," he said, "have I made such a thing. What is it for?" His question brought me back to comfortable territory, masking my panic. I said, "Why, I've shot down a fleet of Nazi attack ships with that. I've mowed down a mob of Venusian Hottentots. I've even burned a hole through Mars's moon and singed fannies on Pluto." I had been infected with the room's atmosphere of malarkey. I gave him another chance to hatch one himself. "They say you're Santa Claus," he said. His face darkened. "Santa Claus," he said, repeating the name as though it hurt. His eyes looked ahead, and he seemed to focus beyond the walls. He's a foolish story for small children. He's a big, jolly bribe to control their natural criminal instincts. He chuckled at this without smiling. It's been that way for a long time, but it wasn't always. His eyes focused back on me. Smiling sadly, he said, "He's old now, and the times are newer. People are newer." He studied my ray gun again. "Who'd believe now?" "I believe," I said, but I wasn't sure at all. I had to see what the old fruitcake had up his sleeve. "I believe if he could make a reindeer fly." So Santa Claus goes to the fireplace and he concentrates. He's pointing at a little reindeer statue on the mantle, thinking hard, thinking hard, thinking hard. Nothing happens except for the dog, who starts floating in the back, looking extremely flustered. So the little boy reveals, "I do wish for something." Well, the old man, his eyes fully lit up this time. And I was already at the edge, so I leapt. "An official Bucktweed two-speed Crime Stopper Starhopper bicycle," I said. He frowned and looked at me as if I'd asked for a blue cantaloupe. I described my prize again, saying each word slowly and louder. He bent down over the back of the elf and cupped his ear. I made it simple. "I'd like a tweed bicycle." "That's what you want? You're quite sure?" he said, looking surprised. "I'm sure. A tweed bicycle. It's the latest thing." The old man straightened up and scratched his head. "I'll try my best," he said, grinning. I roped Amelia and hauled her down from the overhead beams. She was near emotional collapse during the walk home, but then I was too. On Christmas morning, I woke to the air colored pink, which I took as a sign of coming paradise. Slipping down the hall, I paused and crossed my fingers for luck before viewing the prize that would guarantee my happiness to old age. Our pitiful tree was tucked against the wall, looking lonely and pitiful as usual. And also as usual, the room was empty of buck tweed bicycles. Completely, utterly, terribly empty. Well, rather than taking this lying down, our little monster decides he's going to go give the old man a what for. Stomping through the woods, leaving a blue, great purple fog of cussing residue wafting against the Vashon strawberry fields. Some say it's still drifting about today, causing panic among the rabbits. And when he gets up to the old house, there's the old man lying in bed, surrounded by a whole room full of pointy-eared people. And he says, looking at me, "We're having a going-away party. These old elf's friends were kind enough to see me off." His arms rose, shakily outstretched. His eyebrows went high as if waiting for some sort of wonderful news. "Come closer," he said, eyes glistening. "Tell me exactly what you thought of your special bicycle." "Oh, I'd tell him exactly, all right." I paused to organize my fit, but as the steam built up and the vile words arranged themselves, a new emotion began to build, pushing aside my anger. I fought it back, but to my horror, it kept coming. The Red Ranger of Mars, protector of the 23rd century and savior of grateful princesses, faced a new enemy, tears. As I think back now, after so many years, it seems they came from more than just a bicycle beyond reach. But before they arrived, the old man's hand reached out toward my own. Years of brainless kid instinct obscured my emotions, and I grasped it. Even through my brimming tantrum, I noticed it was damp and trembling. His eyes stared at mine, looking for a word of Red Ranger approval. They seemed to beg for it. Why, old Santa Claus was nervous. The sad, failing old man, whoever he was, truly believed he'd delivered to me my Christmas wish. And then up from some unexpected, unexplored crevice inside me, from a place that I did not know, came something new in my experience. I opened my mouth and watched helpless as it all poured out. "The bicycle! Of course, that bicycle! Sir, I have never quite had such a glorious machine in all my life. You may have noticed my face actually glowing just now. That was from pride. Using skills gained over a lifetime of telling whoppers." I launched into a soaring account. of the adventures I'd planned aboard a bicycle that I knew I did not have. His eyes blazed to life with each growing fiction, meeting each swoop from the truth with clapping hands and triumphant woo-wee. After I finished, I sat back, winded from the torrent of joyful fibbery. I was feeling strangely happy, while it occurred to me that I had no particular reason to be happy at all. "Let's go home," I said to Amelia, who jumped. She hadn't seen me smile before and figured I was having a seizure. Well, as I turned to leave, I noticed that the elves seemed to be agitated. At the door, I looked back to see several of them trying gently to keep the old man in his bed. Color had temporarily filled his cheek, and he struggled to his feet. Grinning impishly, he motioned for silence and then bent to elf ear level. He whispered, "Boys, we're back." The little men looked mortified. Turning to me, he smiled and said, "It's been a pleasure having the Red Ranger call." I saluted, "Then I'll call again. I meant it, but that's the last I ever saw that old man." And then all the elves start floating up into the air, and you know where they are headed. And on his way home, the boy looks up, and there it is. The old man had delivered it, after all, a treed bicycle. Stands there in all of his wonder. And the story is absolutely true because it's still there. Thank you.
That's a hard one to follow. I didn't bring my papers with me, but I have a story to tell that is my own experience, so I guess I don't have to have any papers. About celebrating the return of the light, which to me is what this time of year is all about. And so when I was about 6 years old, we went to Rangoon, Burma. My father worked for the government, so we went to live there for a few years. And one of my favorite times during those 3 years that we were living there was what we called the Light Festival. And why I would have used my papers at this point was to tell you what they actually call it in Burmese. But the English name for it is the Light Festival, which happened every November. And it was... amazing because it was so much like Christmas, you know, to us. There were cellophane lanterns that people built with little bamboos, and they were in the shapes of stars and, oh, various geometric shapes. And they were constructed large enough so that you could put a candle, and there was a little container in the middle of the lantern. So each lantern had an actual burning candle in it. And these were strung up all over town. And some of them were just cylinders, and some of them were big stars, huge stars. And some of them had more than one candle. And the whole city of Rangoon, we would drive out just the way you would drive out in a city in this country to see the Christmas lights, to see the Christmas lights all around people's homes and the temples. And when we had lights all over our around our house, too. We were always outside. And one thing that I remember about the Light Festival is that almost every night there was a fire. You know, almost every night the fire department would have to go out and put out fires around the temples or somewhere in the city. And I remember just thinking as a seven-year-old, you know, I mean, why can't they find another way to do it? And I was not sophisticated enough to realize that they didn't have, the electricity. Well, they had electricity, but they didn't have it to the extent that we had it in this country. And the temples had no electricity, and most of the people didn't have electricity in their homes. So that was my young childhood experience. And I love to think about the Light Festival. and the Burmese people, generally speaking, because they were always so sweet and kind and fun people, and they seem to love everyone. Of course, when you're a child, you know, everybody's nice to you, I guess. So, I wanted to say, too, which I had not realized until I started reading about the Light Festival, which is, in fact, the Burmese form of welcoming back the sun after winter. Even though it's warm all year round, they do recognize that there's a period where it's cooler. But I wanted to say that a mystery happened to me when I was 7 years old living in Rangoon, Burma, or to my whole family. A mysterious thing happened. And it was right around the Light Festival. And I finally realized just this week when I was looking through my material for learning more about the Light Festival what had happened. But here's what happened. One morning, I woke up, and of course it was fairly warm in the nights, so I didn't notice anything. But when I went downstairs to breakfast, my mother was having, you know, conniption fits, and she was talking to one of the, we call him our bearer, or you would call him a butler, I guess, and asking him questions. And he was the only servant that we had that spoke English and could understand, so he had to be the translator. Well, it came out that overnight, the curtains in our dining room had disappeared. Now, we had big, tall windows. The curtains were probably about 20 feet long, you know, and big, huge curtains. They disappeared. And what I had not realized was that the top sheet off my brother's and my bed had also disappeared, very mysteriously. And I'm not sure if anything else disappeared, but I know for sure that it was the top sheets off my brother's and my bed and the curtains in the dining room. And as I was reading and researching, there is a special thing that a tradition that they have in Burma around the Light Festival. And I wish I could remember the name that they have for it, but it's a tradition among young men, which maybe encourages their criminal element, of playing a trick on a neighbor, on neighbors. And they go out in the middle of the night, like at 2 a.m, and they take something from the home, you know, or they play another kind of trick. You know, maybe they, I don't know, leave a pet or a puppy or something. They do something that you get up in the morning and, you know, you can't understand why it happened. But at the time, and right up until this week, I always thought that it had been a theft. And I can't check with my mom to see if these things were returned or if she ever found out what it was. Because, you know, when you're a child, you know, it's just like a terrible thing. Someone stole something, you know. So I always remembered that. But maybe it was just a friendly prank. And I'm kind of thinking that's probably what it was. Because why would anyone want a top sheet off a bed? So anyway, the Light Festival and being in Burma for Christmas was a wonderful experience that I always remember. And, of course, my first Christmases were always, even before Burma, when we were in South America, were always warm, and there was never any snow. So this is a treat for me to have white Christmas with you guys. So I haven't bored anybody too much, but that's my offering, and Happy New Year.
Well, we have about 2 minutes for you to, if we have someone who would like to share a very quick snippet of the story they have of the season, we'd love to hear from you. Is there anyone who would like to share a quick story? Well, seeing none, then I have... Oh, Inel, thank you.
Growing up, our family tradition was to put the Christmas tree up the Christmas Eve. And we, as the boys, we lived out in the country in Postenkill. And Bern and Mark and Kent would go out and cut down one of the little cedars off our land Christmas Eve and bring it in and decorate it. So that was sort of the family tradition we continued. And I just pulled my tree out last night, which is not quite Christmas Eve, but it has been our family tradition to always do Christmas Eve, so it's kind of strange to me to see Christmas trees come up after Thanksgiving. But, and of course, growing up in Mexico, we didn't have snow. But up in Postenkill, we had lots of snow. So we had lots of beautiful white Christmases out in our little tent in the woods in Postenkill.
Hi, well, I'm actually going to switch the order and have the last reading before, thank you, Inel, to have the last reading before we sing, because it just seems like it's a song that shouldn't be interrupted. So I have a brief statement, which I know you will have been familiar with this. And this is by William Allen White, an abbreviation. Not believe in Santa Claus? You might as well not believe in fairies. You might get your papa to hire men to watch all the chimneys on Christmas Eve to catch Santa Claus, but even if they did not see Santa Claus coming down, what would that prove? The most real things in the world are those that neither children nor men can see. Did you ever see fairies dancing on the lawn? Of course not, but that's no proof that they are not there. Nobody can conceive or imagine all the wonders there are unseen and seen in the world. You tear apart the baby's rattle and see what makes the noise inside, but there is a veil covering the unseen world, which not the strongest man, nor even the united strength of all the strongest men that ever lived could tear apart. Only faith, fancy, poetry, love, romance can push aside that curtain and view and picture the supernatural beauty and glory beyond. Is it all real? Ah, Virginia, in all this world there is nothing else real and abiding. No Santa Claus? Thank God he lives and lives forever, 1,000,000 years from now, Virginia. Nay, 10 times 10,000 years from now, he will continue to make glad the hearts of childhood. Now, would you please join us in our ending song, Deck the Halls. Yay! Deck the Hall. Okay, good pitch, Dick. How about love? Is that good?
Yeah.
Holly, fa-la-la-la.